You don't need special gadgets to be a hero. With unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere, the Capital One Quicksilver Card makes you the hero of every purchase. Whether it's headphones, a lounge chair, or even a well-deserved massage, whatever the Quicksilver purchase, you're the hero. No fighting bad guys, getting in epic car chases, or parachuting out of buildings required. Simple, isn't it? The Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
When I found out I was going to be a parent, I immediately felt a lot of anxiety and worry. So I went on to BetterHelp to try to look for a therapist to help me with that.
My relationship with my family and with my boyfriend and with myself were suffering. I really needed help.
I was ruminating a lot. Really getting those thoughts out to a therapist and getting feedback was just life-changing.
If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, visit BetterHelp.com/stuff today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/stuff.
Hey, Phoenix, Arizona and surrounding Desert Mesa. We have some big news. You guys bought so many tickets. We have actually changed theaters to a bigger theater.
Yeah, we moved from the Van Buren, which is very beautiful, right around the block to the amazing Orpheum Theater so that more of you Phoenixidians can show up and see us because we want to see as many of you as possible.
Yeah, otherwise everything is the same. So if you have tickets to that Van Buren show, then they count for the Orpheum show, obviously. Mm-hmm. And now there are a whole lot more tickets for you desert dwellers, and I can't wait to see you all and your lovely tans and your scorpions and your tarantulas and your rattlesnakes.
Yep, so we'll be there on Wednesday, October 24th at the Orpheum Theater. And if you haven't gotten tickets yet, you can get them by going to sysklive.com, our clearinghouse for Stuff You Should Know Live.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and sitting across from me is Charles W. Chuckus Chinkus Bryant.
And sitting to your right is ghost producer
Casper.
Nobody.
It was Ramsey, guest producer Ramsey. We've got like all these new guest producers coming on, hot and heavy.
I know. Jerry had to, she had to leave today, and I think everyone's busy. And so someone came in.
There's also a distinct lack of interest I picked up on.
Boy, remember the days when people used to jump at a chance to sit in here?
Oh, yeah. Now they're like, I've got to mail something.
I know. Used to be like, oh, my gosh. Jerry's gone. Let me do it.
Yeah. Now then they grew up.
Yeah. And then they grew up and now we have our little dunking bird to peck the key.
Yeah.
The R record button.
Yeah. Just going back and forth thinking about where its life went wrong.
Just us.
Just us, Chuck, and a guy named Dinghis Khan. Do you pronounce it Dinghis or Genghis or Chinggis?
Are you being serious?
I know it's not Dinghis, but I've also seen it spelled in a way that would suggest you.
It's Genghis, you dingus.
You pronounce it Chinggis.
Oh, really? I think I have heard that.
Mm-hmm. But we're going to go with the general Genghis pronunciation, okay?
Right, although his, what was his birth name? Timujin?
Mm-hmm. Doesn't even, Genghis Khan isn't even his real name, everybody, so calm down. It's Temujin.
Man, did you see that statue?
I've seen it before, yes. It's enormous.
Have you seen it in person?
No.
No.
I've not yet been to Mongolia.
That's something else, man.
I will one day, though. Yeah, no, it's the world's biggest equestrian statue, and with good reason. It's like 40 meters or 130 feet tall.
Yeah.
That's an enormous statue.
It's pretty impressive.
Whether you're on a horse or not, that's a big old statue, right?
Sure.
I almost didn't say old. And I think it's made of like 250 tons of stainless steel, which means it rinses clean really well.
Mm-hmm. And it looks like, I saw the wide shot, it doesn't look like one of those that's, you know, surrounded by Burger Kings.
Oh, good.
Looks like there's a lot of land around it.
Well, Mongolia has a lot of land, a lot of undeveloped land from what I understand.
Yeah, this was an interesting one because depending on what kind of historian you are, he is either a revered mastermind or a scorned
butcher.
Butcher, yeah.
I know. He's actually, you think, both.
Well, of course he was both.
But yeah,
sure.
There are definite camps for sure. Like a lot of people, I've seen them called the pro Genghis camp.
Mm-hmm. The pro G.
Yeah. That they're all about like all the cultural transmission that happened under his rule.
Yeah.
Or all the new innovative laws or religious tolerance was another one.
Yeah.
And yes, you like all that stuff happened. It's not in dispute. Like there are a lot of things that we'll talk about that were really positive. But he's also directly responsible for the deaths of about 35 million people.
Yeah, the anti-G.
Over a 25-year period.
Mm-hmm.
That's a ridiculous amount of death of people who, had Genghis Khan not been born and, you know, decided to lead a conquest,
yeah,
would probably otherwise not have died violently. That's a big mark in his favor or against him. Well, my morality just switched off there for a second.
So you got the pro-G, the anti-G,
yep,
and the ally-G.
Right.
That's the third camp.
Yeah.
The Booyakasha.
Booyakasha.
I miss that.
Oh, it's good stuff.
It is.
But they tried to bring it back, remember, and it was like—
Oh, really? Was there a part two?
No.
Or a 2.0?
That's the problem. They didn't do new stuff. It was just him introducing old stuff. And it was like, we want more new stuff. We've all seen this
old stuff.
A bunch. It was like for a month on FX.
But they shot new hosting segments?
Yes, that were like 15 seconds long.
So basically they said, hey, Sacha Baron Cohen, how'd you like to make another X amount of dollars?
Right.
By showing up for a day.
How would you like to do the Ollie G version of SYSK Selects?
Ooh.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to examine that one too closely.
All right. So we're talking about Ollie G. I mean, Genghis Khan, right?
Yeah. And just some large statistics right off the bat as far as his influence. Well, not his influence, but his rule in sheer numbers.
Yeah. This is the reason we're still talking about him, not just because he killed so many people.
Yeah. Agreed. By the time, you know, of course, everyone knows he was a great conqueror who just kept branching out further and further. And
right.
This is how far he reached. Eventually, in modern day terms, he would reach Austria.
Austria. He banged on the door of Austria. His son did.
Just get out a world map and look at where Mongolia is. So Austria, Finland, Croatia, Hungary, Poland, Vietnam, Burma, Japan, and Indonesia. 12 million contiguous square miles.
Which is the size of?
Africa.
Again?
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then to put that in context, you know, the great Roman Empire, that was about half the size of the United States.
Yeah, the Roman Empire was half the size of the United States.
Yeah.
It took them 400 years to amass that.
Yeah.
In 25 years, Genghis Khan had an empire the size of Africa.
Yeah, and then at the time, the population of the world was about 7 billion people, and the Mongolian Empire was about 3 billion of that. So it's just astounding.
It is astounding. And to put it in like true cultural or true historic context, at the time, in say like the early 13th century, the Mongols were the Mongols, a bunch of nomadic tribes on the steppes of Mongolia. China was a well-established and fairly advanced patchwork of dynasties.
Yeah.
You had like Europe growing in they were in the Middle Ages, but they were like, the Renaissance is coming not too long.
Yeah.
You had the Native Americans over in America doing
sure.
their thing, Africa doing their thing. So there's all these different things going on in the world. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this tiny little bunch of people who aren't even into agriculture take over Eurasia.
Yeah.
In 25 years.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere and kill 35 million people.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. It'd be like if Polynesia suddenly rose up and took over the Americas.
Yeah.
In 25 years. They just assembled and said, we're taking over. And they were just so ferocious that America just didn't even know what to do and was overrun by them.
Yeah. And their rule was not long lasting for a lot of the reasons that there's a lot of ironies, you know. A lot of the reasons that they were able to spread so fast ended up being their undoing. But this is all just setup fodder.
Yeah. We haven't even gotten into it yet. So let's do start, okay?
Phew.
Back in people think the best guess is probably, I think, 1185, I saw. There was a kid named Temujin, mm-hmm. 1162, I'm sorry. And he was born in a place called, well, along the Onon River, near Ulaanbaatar, which is a great name, but that's the capital of Mongolia.
There's five A's in that.
That's a lot of A's.
That's a lot of A's.
And this kid, this Temujin, who would grow up to be Genghis Khan, was not Genghis Khan material from the outset.
No, he was, he was a middle brother, mm-hmm. and apparently both younger and older brother outshone him.
Yeah, he was very much the Jam Brady of his family.
He was, because apparently little brother was a much better athlete and a better, you know, arrow shooter, or I guess you would call them archers. kind of better at everything, and then his older brother picked on him. He was illiterate. He wasn't, like, formally schooled or super smart.
Right, right. But, I mean, in his defense, neither were most of the people he knew or
sure.
lived on the steppes.
Yeah, it's not like his two brothers, like, got their doctorates, their PhDs.
Yeah, in kicking butt.
Well, that's true. But he was, I wish I knew more about this whole era, because it sounds like it was just a crazy time, especially over there, where people would be like, if I want something, I'm just going to go take it.
Yeah.
If I want that tribe gone, I'm going to go kill them. If I want those ladies and children, I'm going to kidnap them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just sort of how the land was ruled.
Yeah.
It was kind of not chaos, but just brute force.
Lawless.
Yeah. Pretty lawless.
And you were loyal to your tribe or your clan,
mm-hmm.
And your tribe or clan was nomadic, and you lived by the horse, and yeah, you there was a lot of war between these tribes on the steppes.
Yeah, tiny wars.
Like you said, kidnapping. Like, you would kidnap your wife. That's mm-hmm. how you got your wife, was you go kidnap her from another tribe and be like, you're my wife now.
That's how his mother came about, right?
Yes, that's how he came about, was his father kidnapped his mother. His father was the chief of his tribe. What's his father's name?
Yasugi.
Nice. And Yasugi kidnapped Hulun.
Yeah, there's a lot of umlauts in there. I don't know how the umlaut represents Mongolian dialect.
Well, we're going to do it German style. So her name is Hulun. Is that pretty German?
Mertly Crew.
So she was kidnapped. And I this is the thing, like, I have no context to put this in.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a common thing, was she like, oh, I'm being kidnapped, okay, like, I guess I'm 18 now or something. Like, this is just a normal course of events for her, so it didn't impact her?
I don't know.
Or is that just a ridiculous thing to even think? And, like, yes, if you were kidnapped and taken from your tribe and made to be some dude's wife unwillingly, it doesn't matter where it happened or when it happened, it was a horrific experience.
I think it was that, and just sort of the way it was. Women were just had no recourse or say in anything mm-hmm. at the time.
So it was both.
But, like, I think I know what you're saying, though. Like, mm-hmm. you know, she had these children, and they were, quote, family.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean in that context?
Yeah, is it a family if mom's, like, looking for an escape route for
right.
the whole life?
Right.
Yeah.
Either way, it was not like people were courting one another back then.
Right. So Yasugi, right? That's mm-hmm. what we decided on?
Yes.
Yasugi was the chief, like I said, of the clan, of the tribe, a very powerful dude. And he was poisoned, actually. He died by poisoning when Temujin was 9. And that was bad news for Temujin, his mom, and his two brothers.
Yeah, they were just sort of kicked out of this new tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why. I guess because he was the son of
Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't want anybody being like, oh, by the way, I'm the rightful heir.
Right.
I should really be the chief of this tribe. I'm very surprised that they didn't just kill all of them.
Yeah, because that's kind of the way it usually went.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they were kicked out. So he had a rough childhood. They were not... They had to scavenge for food. I reckon it toughened him up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But as our article points out, that he it kind of gave him a will to – and probably ticked him off. So he had anger and will.
Vengeance.
And vengeance all rolled up into one, which says a lot about, like, the man that he would become, I think.
For sure. So he and his family make it. not all of his family. There's a story called The Secret History of the Mongols, and it was written in about 1240, so shortly after Genghis Khan's death. We don't know who the author was, but that's the primary source for most of the biography of Genghis Khan.
They know a lot, or
at
a
least
lot,
because
to.
Somebody sat down and wrote this, and we'll see eventually why. But the that's where we're getting all of this information, which is also why if you listen to the history of Genghis Khan, a lot of it sounds like a string of fables and tales wrapped together.
For sure.
But historians tend to think that there's some kernel of truth or just outright truth to most of it.
Should we take a break?
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a break and we'll talk about what young Temujin was like. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. And you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests in tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture, shall we? You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that might not be for you.
That's right, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle.
How? Good question. Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic.
But you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. So visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. All right, so we said that he was a bit of a crybaby, got picked on, wasn't very athletic or strong, but he had charm, he had chutzpah, he had charisma.
And a little bit of moxie.
And definitely, you got to throw in some moxie. And apparently he was able, through his charisma, to talk people into helping him out, and that became sort of a trait through his life.
Right.
And they give a couple of examples. One time he was going after a horse thief. And he just ran upon a stranger and kind of convinced the guy to not only give him a horse, but to help him out.
Yeah, he really attracted people into his orbit, from what I understand.
Yeah, he was like...
like Gilbert Gottfried.
It's funny, because I knew I was trying to think of someone legitimately, and I knew that you were headed down a different path.
You know, the opposite of that?
What else? There was another time that... he had a bride-to-be, or maybe I think he was married.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
And she was kidnapped, because that's how it went. Mm-hmm. And so he went to the leader of another tribe and said, hey, take this sable skin. It was one of my wedding gifts.
And he goes, oh, nice.
Yeah, he was pretty impressed, apparently, because he helped him rescue the wife and then pledged his allegiance to him as an ally for life, I guess.
Yeah, he said, not only am I going to help you get your wife, you're going to go on to do great things, and I want to be there with you. Love me. So there's just tons of stories like that, early stories where he was held prisoner he was kidnapped himself and escaped by beating the guy watching him with the wooden collar that he had fastened around his neck.
Mm-hmm.
There's just tons of stories like that. If you put it together, you can kind of see this guy develop over time, right?
Sure.
But eventually,
he probably hit the weights eventually.
Right. Yeah. as he grows up and develops, and more people kind of come into his orbit and want to help him out, he starts putting that charisma and that vengeance to, I guess, productive use. And he assembles like his own tribe and other tribes. He starts allying with other tribes, and the tribes that don't go along with it, he slaughters in war. Mm-hmm. He was known for having like an eye for other talent, which would aid him tremendously throughout his years as a conqueror. But for example, if you were a good enemy soldier, and he noted that in battle,
yeah,
there was a good chance that you were going to end up a field commander on his side,
yeah,
after the battle was over and he beat your guys.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually a story where his horse was shot out from under him. And after his group won the battle, the Mongols won the battle, he wanted to know who shot that arrow. And the guy on the other side stood up and said, "It was me." And he said, Your name is Jebe now, which means arrow,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to become a field commander for me." And he went on to be one of the best he ever had.
And the guy was like, "Is he messing with me?
Right?
Am I about to get my head chopped off?"
Yeah. But that was pretty par for the course with him. And so through these actions, he started assembling like an army, and became the leader of the steppes.
Yeah, and people, like you said, if they challenged him, they were squashed. Mm-hmm. He had a surrender or die policy, which apparently if you literally did not fight and you were just like, "Okay, we're all yours."
Right.
Apparently he was okay to you. He wasn't known for torturing people. I don't know if he, you know, I don't want to say he was kind to them, but I think he kind of wanted his subjects to be happy and productive.
Right.
So if they didn't fight him, he was like, "All right, you're part of the big extended Khan family.
Come here. Come here, you. Thank you for your kingdom."
Although he isn't Khan at this point still.
No, that didn't take place until, I believe, 1206.
Yeah, that's when the Mongol tribes all got together. They had a great assembly called Kurultai, and they said, "You know what? You're the man. You're Genghis Khan now. Mm-hmm. We are all on your team because, quite frankly, we're scared of you."
Right, we're scared. We're so scared.
So, and he was like, "Hey, that's fine."
Yeah. So Genghis Khan, they think Khan means ruler.
Yeah.
Indisputably. Genghis, they're not 100% sure what they meant by it, because it can mean ocean or just. So they think they were saying like supreme, like the leader all the way to the ocean.
Sure.
And then you run into Triton. You don't want to mess with him.
Right.
But up to Triton's area, this guy is the leader. So that's what they meant by it, like ocean leader.
He wasn't Aquaman?
No.
So they're unified now, and he said, I have to assemble a nation here. I've got all these tribes. I want a unified people.
Yeah, that was a big move.
It was, and it was a smart move. And all these old clans got together, people that were enemies joined forces. I don't know if they became, you know, best buds or anything.
Well, one of the things they did is they renounced these old rivalries.
Yeah.
They stopped warring with each other. They stopped robbing one another.
Yeah.
And they started identifying not as these individual clans, but as Mongols.
Yeah, and like strength in numbers. I think they realized this could benefit us all.
Right.
If we're one big powerful group.
Right, but numbers is relative though, man.
Like, sure.
From what I saw at its peak, the army of Genghis Khan had about 100,000 men.
Yeah, which is peanuts.
It is peanuts. So why were they – should we get into why they were successful yet? Or this,
yeah.
Okay. So why were they successful?
Well, a few reasons. One of the biggest is these dudes could ride horses, mm-hmm. and shoot arrows like nobody's business.
Yeah.
They were incredible they had an incredible cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first that – whoever wrote that article you sent, that one historian, he was great.
Yeah.
So he pointed out that he realized that the cavalry didn't need to be followed by an infantry, which was a huge advantage, I guess, in battle.
Yeah. You needed far fewer guys.
Yeah, and just get everyone up on a horse.
Yep.
They were incredible archers. Their accuracy was unmatched. They could fire an arrow, apparently like over 300 yards accurately.
Mm-hmm.
These horses were awesome. They were grass-fed. They could live off the land. They had this armor that was really lightweight and flexible. So, you know, at the time, they were fighting people in much heavily armored apparel. So they could move around better.
Right.
You know, on their horses, they were firing arrows, and they had these little short swords, and they had this thing called a hooked lance. And they're like, a lance is all right. It's cool, I guess, to poke someone off a horse. But what if you can poke them or grab them?
Mm-hmm.
So they added a hook to the lance, a very simple feature.
Right.
And it really changed things. It was like a modern evolution in weaponry.
Right.
So these are just a few of the reasons. One of the others is tactics and strategy.
Yeah.
He would scout out before battles for weeks sometimes. He wouldn't just go as brutish as they were. They would spend a lot of time doing research and spying.
Yeah.
And really kind of figuring out a game plan.
Like if they were going to sack a city, like they knew where the trade line or the supply lines were.
Sure.
Escape routes, you know, all that kind of stuff. All the stuff you need to know to sack a city.
Yeah.
One of the other things, so part one, I saw it called a quantum leap in military strategy and technology.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the first thing. The other thing is something you touched on earlier, their surrender or die policy.
Yeah.
Right. So their military prowess combined with their tactics and their policy of if you don't just say yes, that's fine. We don't want to fight. We're going to kill everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Just about everybody. And they were actually pretty smart about it, too. They'd find, like, the skilled craftsmen in some cities and
engineers.
Be like, we're going to spare your life because you're now a Mongol.
Yeah.
You got to move to Mongolia, by the way. But they would just kill so many people that a lot of historians have tried to figure out why were they so ferocious. And there have actually been a number of theories that have been put up. One is, Genghis Khan was he was into shamanism. That was his religion.
Yeah.
But he was like fervently religious about shamanism. And there was like a great god of the sky who I think is analogous to Vishnu maybe in Hinduism. And this god supposedly gave him a vision that he should become conqueror of the world.
Yeah.
And so some people have said, well, he, you know, if you opposed him, you were opposing his God, and so there was no room for that, and that's what made him so ferocious.
Yeah.
Probably the best explanation, though, is that if one of their 100,000 horsemen died, that was a big deal, right?
Yeah.
So to save their numbers, they were better off not fighting. So by slaughtering an entire city, that word about that gets around the area. So when those guys show up to your city, there's a pretty good chance that if they say surrender or die, you're going to surrender. And so the Mongols didn't have to sacrifice a single person.
Yeah, and also get the idea. I mean, we're going to talk about his major sieges, but he also had a lot of smaller skirmishes with just kind of regional tribes, I think. And I got the idea that he wouldn't send all his dudes in there. He would send in a small amount of people as possible.
Right.
Because they were so fierce and good at what they did, he didn't need to. And then that also reduced the chances of loss of life, I guess.
And then, so the smallest units, that 100,000-man army boiled down to units as small as 10 people.
Yeah.
That was the individual unit, was a 10-person cavalry group.
Yeah.
And, you could just say send 5 groups in or 1,000 groups in or whatever.
Yeah.
There you go.
And he would also, as he went, he would pick up whatever weaponry and tactics that other armies used and use those. Because one thing that was pretty clear in reading this, Genghis Khan did not like walls and and walled cities.
I saw that too.
It ticked him off, especially for some reason.
Why would you do that?
No. Yeah. So he, he got catapults and things like that. And he would do some awful things like with ladders and catapults. He would fling diseased animals. Like that wasn't, I don't know, he wasn't the only one to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But some of this seems like lore, though, the thing with the cats and the birds.
Yeah, he told one city that he'd spare them if they gave him 1,000 cats and 10,000 birds. And they gathered up their 10,000 birds, which I guess they had, and 1,000 cats and gave them to him. And then he set the cats and the birds on fire and flung them over the walls to start fires in the city.
Well, supposedly Kide Cotton
to
them and set that on fire.
Oh, well, that's much better.
But I'm sure the fire spreads.
It does seem apocryphal.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe that.
Apocryphal, by the way, I just learned in like the last year or so means—
That word?
Made up.
You didn't know that's— Untrue. You never heard the word or—
No, I've heard it plenty of times. I just didn't realize. I always assumed it meant like biblical and end of times.
Oh, interesting.
Because it's resemblance to apocalypse. I've got one more for you.
What's that?
I just this week learned what coup de grace actually means. I thought it meant like the cream of the crop, the ultimate. It's the death blow. Like there's nothing after it, not because it's the best.
Right.
Because you just had your head cut off.
Yeah, the coup de grace.
Yeah.
Yeah, the final blow.
Just learned that this week.
Yeah, I think I knew that. You know what word I used to always get wrong was dubious.
Did you think it meant pot?
I don't know. Yeah. Can you score me some dubious?
Did you ever listen to Funk Dubious? They were like this rap group from the 90s.
Yeah,
that had like a
I remember
couple
Funk
hits.
Dubious.
They were great. They all they wanted to do was have fun. In the midst of like the whole gangster rap
Funk
thing. Funk Dubious.
I totally remember that.
Yeah.
Boy, they just went away. I haven't heard that name in—
I think they had like one album and that was it.
What was their big hit?
Oh, I don't even remember, but I'll bet it had to do with pot.
Probably so. All right, so he's got Mongolia pretty well taken care of
at this point. What did you think dubious meant? I made a joke instead of letting you answer.
No, I don't remember what I thought it meant, but I think I just used to get it wrong.
We'll go back to Funk Dubious.
So he's got Mongolia pretty well under control, and he is insatiable, though, Genghis Khan is. He starts looking around, and he's like, China is big.
You look pretty.
And I think even though they are wealthy and tough and have a lot of dudes to fight, I think I can take them because I'm Genghis Khan.
Which is a nutso thing to say at that time.
Sure.
Especially depending on which of the dynasties in China you were talking about, because I think there were at least three major ones.
Well, he's like, all of them. Let's just go one at a time.
Yeah. So that's what he did.
Yeah, that's exactly what he did.
He started with the— I'm sorry, everybody. I'm having trouble keeping up with all of the names, but the Tanguts?
Yeah, the kingdom of Zhejia is how I would probably pronounce it. Is that
not
right?
Not Dixie Chang.
No.
Yeah,
I think
it's
about that.
Zhejia.
Yeah, Zhejia and the Tanguts. And I think this was sort of a test, his biggest test militarily at the time.
Yeah, it was. He'd been fighting other tribes on the steppes to consolidate them and killing off the resistors. They didn't have cities. The Tanguts were the first ones that he encountered that had like cities with walls that were fortified that he needed to figure out how to lay siege to.
Yeah, and he did, to the point where the king finally said, all right, you are my master, here are my troops, and here's a princess bride as well.
Right.
Because I've heard you get around.
Yeah. And Genghis Khan said, as you wish.
That's right.
Isn't that what he said?
I think so.
Okay.
So then next he said, all right, how about this other region, the Qin Kingdom? And he faced a 70,000-man army, and it said virtually wiped it out in this article.
So he's working his way up here now.
Yeah.
So he actually hit the Chins twice, from what I understand. And this How Stuff Works article says it happened in 2013. So I'll bet the Chins were quite surprised to see Genghis Khan show up 5 years ago.
Yeah, I wonder why. It says that he came back and got a bunch of silk and gold and got a bunch of engineers. I wonder if that was the purpose of that mission.
Maybe.
Was like, hey, I don't think we properly raided them.
Yeah, because this was 2 years after the first one. I guess that's all it was, that he wanted some more silk and gold.
And, again, appropriating weapons like crossbows, catapults, and, because it's China, early versions of explosives.
Right. And so he's using all this stuff. He's not married to just the hook pole and just the saber. He'll try out anything he sees works, right?
Yeah.
So he's knocked out the first two dynasties. He's brought them under his control. He now controls a significant portion of China, all of the steppes around Mongolia.
Yeah.
And he's got his sights set on the biggest one of the three, the Jin Dynasty.
Yes.
And he actually got in contact with them or else they got in contact with him first, but the emperor of the Jin dynasty. This is an advanced civilization at this point. Very wealthy, maybe the most advanced and wealthy civilization on the planet at the time.
Maybe.
Genghis Khan is a backwoods redneck horse rider who just happened to get lucky a couple of times, caught the other two dynasties slipping.
Well, sure.
That's what the emperor of the Jin dynasty is thinking.
Yeah, he's thinking, right? You're going to be my slave.
Yeah, he's like, you've done pretty good, kid. I'll tell you what. I'll let you look over my land in the south. You'll be my vassal. And here's a princess bride. I hear you like him.
Yeah, but it did not work out that way.
No, it didn't. He actually successfully defeated the most advanced, wealthiest society on the planet at the time, the Jinns.
Yep, slaughtered thousands and thousands of people.
Well, that's how you do it, I guess. And these three campaigns, these are huge, enormous campaigns. China was extremely populous at the time. And the number of people who died, most of the people who died under Genghis Khan's rule through war and conquest happened during these three China campaigns.
Yeah.
About 30 million people died. And this is over, 10 years, I think. Less than 10 years.
Yeah, I think so.
It's nuts, man.
Yeah, so he wanted to continue going, west. 1219, he made his way through modern-day Central Asia, like Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Iran. And the Shah Muhammad there said he killed an ambassador that they had sent forward from a trading caravan. And he had a big walled city, and he's like, I'm going to be fine. I'm not sweating this guy.
Right.
And he burned the city down, Genghis Khan did, including 1,000 of the soldiers who were in a mosque hiding out, killed about 100,000 people. But of course, like you said earlier, he spared the skilled craftsmen and workers.
Right. And this is the Khwarizm?
I think so.
Empire, which its capital city that he sacked is now in Uzbekistan, but I've seen it called mostly like Afghanistan, Iran, for the most part. This is the area it covered. Iran is what I see it mostly compared to these days.
Yeah, and things are starting to get a little out of hand at this point, and it's basically sort of due to the fact that he went too far. There were too many people, too much land. When you control your – I think the guy who wrote that article you sent said that they weren't producers of anything.
The Mongols.
Yeah.
Right.
Or tradesmen.
They were conquerors. That's it.
Yeah, and that's not like – you got to diversify.
From what I understand, they didn't have a written language. They didn't do anything. They just conquered people and took over your land and then leached off of you.
Yeah, which is a good skill to get going, but if that's all you can do, I think he likened it to a shark needing to feed.
Right.
Like eventually you run out of lands to conquer, and then in the interior, it's such a huge corporation at this point,
right.
It gets unwieldy.
So Genghis Khan recognized this at some point.
Yeah.
He saw that he had basically a change of heart about agriculture, about walled cities, about a sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I think he mostly saw like, oh, you can make way more wealth this way. So he turned from conquering as much toward figuring out how to administer this area that he conquered. Again, Eurasia is conquered. It's under this guy's had never been united before and hasn't been united since. Even under Soviet rule. The Genghis Khan's empire was bigger than that, right? And so he's put it together, and he's like, yeah, what do I do now? And we'll talk about that after this message. How about that?
Yes. Hey, everybody. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good. You're feeling low and not sure you can pull out a win. And that's when you have to dig deep, lift your head up, and say to yourself, time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of your friend's money as you possibly can.
That's right. The smash hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to get the most riches and the biggest empire. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone, anytime, with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress to your buddies.
That's right. You can play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. You can make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball, and you can charge other players rent for your iconic properties.
Plus, you can even work with your friends to crack open community chests and tournaments to get rewards and climb the leaderboard.
So get back out there, put on your game face, and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI and revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Chuck, so Genghis Khan has conquered Eurasia and said, what now? What now, Eurasia? What do you guys want to do now? I'm done with killing. Not really, though.
Well, he died.
Yeah? I guess that's right.
Yeah, and this is, no one knows quite how he died still. Some people say he had a fall from a horse and was injured, eventually died. Other people said it might have been typhus. There are a few other theories floating around out there, but...
Yeah, like shot in the knee with an arrow is my favorite.
Yeah, which I guess just infection.
I would die from pain.
Yeah. it's interesting, though, in August of 1227, when he was on his deathbed, like one of the last things he did was say, you know, remember the Tanguts? Go kill all of them.
Right, that's what he did.
I think they were the first people he conquered, right?
They were the Zhizhe people.
Okay, the first people in China.
And when he went to go attack the Khwarezm Empire,
yeah,
he demanded that they send some troops as reinforcement, and they said no. He defeated the Khwarezm and turned around and went right over to Zhizhe and was like, you guys are, you're toast.
Yeah.
You're in trouble. And that was his last act as a living person.
Yeah, he was succeeded by one of his son, Ogedai.
Who took that stuff all the way to Europe.
Oh, yeah. Like, he had a bunch of sons.
Uh-huh.
And I guess we might as well talk about his lineage. It's very famously the Genghis Khan. I mean, what is it, like one of every 200 men?
Something like 0.5% of the total global population is directly descended from him.
That's amazing.
It's amazing and gross. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, he was about 65-ish when he died, and no one knows where he's buried.
No.
Because they killed everyone on the way to the funeral.
That's one. And then also they rode over his grave.
With horses?
I looked up, do you ever go on Quora?
Sure, now and then.
It's great, man.
Yeah.
Like, you can usually tell... Who knows what they're talking about?
Yeah.
Of the answers, the multiple, and frequently it's most of the people. It's a good serious, like it's a good place to get info that you should then go double check.
Yeah, but I agree though. It's not like the old days of what was the terrible one years and years ago where you would ask a question.
Yahoo questions?
Yeah, probably.
Or Yahoo? Yeah, something like that. Yeah. There are a lot of platforms like this.
Yeah.
This is a pretty good... It's not corrupt yet. How about that?
Yeah, I think Quora is pretty good, actually.
So I went on Quora. This one you can't really look up. But this one guy, two people... Like, the question was, why was Genghis Khan buried in secret, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And two people said they didn't want his grave robbed.
Makes sense.
They wanted to make sure that the transfer of power to his son was complete, so they had to keep his death a secret.
That makes sense.
Yada, yada. This one guy said, don't be idiots. He was a little arrogant, but he said, like, don't be idiots. Genghis Khan was a shamanistic person, religiously fervent.
Yeah.
He would have gone one of two ways. They would have cremated him and just spread his ashes, or they would have done a sky burial. Remember we talked about before? Where they just left him on the mountainside for the vultures to pick over. It wouldn't have buried him with grave goods. He would have been embarrassed with that. So he's the only person I saw say something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it gave me pause. It made me wonder if the hidden grave is just, you know, just a more lore about Genghis Khan and off the mark.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, his legacy looms large still, not only in his lineage from his loins.
His overactive loin just leaching out goop.
But depending on who you're talking to, well, he definitely did some things. He opened up trade.
Right.
The West got things like noodles and tea and playing cards.
Mm-hmm.
He perhaps founded the very first version of what would later be a post office, his, what was it called? The Yam?
Yeah. Like a Pony Express.
Yeah. Like it just different stations.
The Pony Express.
Yeah. Like straight up.
But like 600 years before the Pony Express.
Yeah, exactly. But depending on who you're talking to, some people lay almost all of modern warfare at his feet.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting because you can sort of draw a line back to his tactics that eventually would become the Crusades or the slaughtering of the Aztecs and the Incas.
Yeah, so they say—
like they would learn from him and then do that.
Right. Because it was more that cultural conveyor belt, that right? So they say that he conquered the Khwarezm Empire, came in contact with Islam, and taught them ferocity, which the Europeans learned during the Crusade, and they took that ferocity back to Europe and then eventually to the New World, which they used on the Native Americans they found there. And somebody said, no, the Europeans were already well-versed in ferocity and brutality and warfare. They didn't need to learn it from Genghis Khan. That doesn't mean that's wrong.
Right.
But it's the suggestion that the Europeans were naive to brutality and warfare is incorrect.
Well, it's complete BS. And the author of that article also makes a good point. And, like, you can't look and judge him by today's lens. He wasn't any more brutal than anyone else back then.
It was just the number.
Yeah, he just did it better.
That to me, though, so I guess then maybe my problem is like celebrating people who've killed tons of people.
Yeah.
Like that's what I have a problem at base.
Sure.
Because it's great man history, you know? It bugs me.
It bugs me too.
Sorry,
we didn't come across that way, did we?
No, but just by carrying on the tradition of talking about this guy and, you know, you definitely keep his little flame burning.
Well, and there's a, 150-foot statue of him?
Yeah.
Like, he's still very much revered.
Well, let's talk about that. Like, if you were in Mongolia right now, you're probably pretty mad at me and Chuck. Apologies for that. It's the great man history thing we have a problem with. But in Mongolia, he is known as the founder of Mongolia.
Yeah.
The greatest leader Mongolia has ever known, and possibly the world if you're a Mongolian. And during the Soviet occupation of Mongolia, you were not allowed to talk about him.
Yeah, they like took him out of history books.
Yeah, because they were trying to stamp out any kind of nationalism in Mongolia at the time. So the moment the Soviets left, the Soviet Union dissolved, they were like, Genghis Khan, Genghis Khan, Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
They built a statue of him. They named an airport after him. They put him on currency. So he's definitely revered over there. But I think that the author of the article, I think his name's Frank McLean. I'm almost positive.
It's a really good article.
Yeah, it's great. Frank McLean. He wrote this wonderful article called The Brutal Brilliance of Genghis Khan. But he points out, like, whatever you think of the guy, even if he was the same as his contemporaries and it still seems alien to you,
yeah.
Like, think about your own leaders. Your own leaders send people to to die on the battlefield too.
Yeah.
And they're revered as well.
Sure, for causes that aren't not noble.
Right. So the point is I guess don't hate on Genghis Khan. Hate the game.
Not the player.
Right. I guess so.
Wow.
Boy, this guy took a deep left turn, didn't it?
Well, it is interesting.
Yeah, we could talk about this dude forever.
Yeah, he also makes the point, too, that the Mongols were what he called culturally unbalanced. So he's like, you know, at least the Europeans, while they were slaughtering and killing, were giving us the Divine Comedy and mm-hmm. Carmina Burana and mm-hmm. these great cathedrals and operas, whereas the Mongols were just barbarian raiders and butchers.
All slaughter, no substance.
That's a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Very famously, too, in the movies, Genghis Khan was played twice. Once by John Wayne.
Yep.
Believe it or not. In The Conqueror. And then Omar Sharif.
Okay.
Said Egyptian, also not close to Mongolian.
Right.
I don't know if that's better or worse than John Wayne. It's probably the same.
I think it's worse. Or no, better.
Better. Well, now it'll be Hugh Jackman. No, I think Hollywood's changed somewhat, but like 5 years ago, they would have been like, what about Jason Momoa?
Or Matt Damon, put one of those Fu Manchu mustaches on him.
Or they just pick Momoa because like, he looks tough.
Who's he?
And he looks sort of ethnic. He's the guy that plays Aquaman.
Ah, gotcha.
And is on...
very versatile
he's
ethnically.
He's in Game of Thrones. Probably, but... And I even looked up Mongolian American actors to see if there was anyone out there.
Uh-huh.
Who they could tap into, and I don't think there are a lot of them.
Oh, okay.
So it'd probably have to be some good unknown.
So speaking of looking like a Mongolian, okay? One last thing. Are you done?
I'm done.
The Mongolians were really, really good at propaganda. And one of the ways that they showed this was in Iran, in modern-day Iran, the Khwarezm, Empire,
mm-hmm.
when they subjugated it, one of the things they did is they said, we don't have an alphabet, we don't write things down, but you guys do, and we want to put that to good use. You have great artists. We want you to do a history of the Mongols. And the scribe said, sure, we'll do that. And we want you to do a history of the world, all the great leaders in the world, all the great civilizations in the world. We want you to do those. So they did. They built this, they wrote this huge compendium, mm-hmm. a universal history of the world. But the Mongols had them illustrate, like illuminate the text. And they had them, whenever they drew a leader or a conqueror or an army, they drew them as Mongols.
Oh, interesting.
So they insinuated themselves into history as basically the progenitors of all greatness. And thus justified the subjugation mm-hmm. of this area.
Wow.
And they did it through propaganda. They had like all that like copied, you know, hand copied and distributed as widely as they could.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
There you go. That's it.
All right.
If you want to know more about Mongolia or Genghis Khan or any of that stuff, you can type those words into the search bar at How Stuff Works.
Pick up a book, you dingus.
And since Chuck said that, it's time for listener mail.
Hey, guys. Recently listened to the show about burying Ferraris. I want to share another cool story about an almost buried car. In 2013, Brazilian billionaire Count Chinquinho Scarpa made headlines when he announced he wanted to bury his $500,000 Bentley.
Oh, my.
Like the pharaohs did with their precious possessions, so he could supposedly ride around the afterlife in style. Attracted tons of press and social media buzz, with many people outraged he would do something so selfish. On the day of the burial, tons of Brazilian press and media crews show up to his house to see him bury his Bentley. Huh. But moments before the car is lowered in the ground, the Count pulls a major plot twist and announces he won't be burying the car. And he reveals his true intention to create awareness for organ donation.
Wow.
Because people are buried with something valuable, their organs. And it was all a stunt and a use of social media and buzz marketing to create awareness for organ donation.
That is fantastic, man. What a cool guy.
Really interesting. Anyway, guys, big fan of your show. Learned a lot from your stories over the years. So I wanted to take this chance to share this cool story with you. And that is from Kate Miller, who's looking forward to more stories.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kate. I definitely had not heard about that.
It's a good one.
If you want to let us know a cool story, we want to hear it. You can tweet to us. I'm at Josh Clark and at SYSK Podcast. Chuck's on Facebook.com/MovieCrush and /CharlesWChuckBryant and /StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us all an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.